All right, this evening we're going to pick up in verse 5. We finished up the eldership last week, and yet Peter is not quite finished with the eldership because he starts with the word likewise. And whenever you see that word likewise, you're saying basically equally or in the same way. So there's something that Peter just said to the elders that applies equally to the younger people in the congregation. And so as you look at the verse a few times, I really think since it's all directed to the elders, there's really one or two options. Either it's talking about the crown of glory, or it's talking about the elders among you I exhort, and then in like manner you younger people I exhort. So Peter has finished directing to the eldership. He's promised them a crown of life if they will be faithful, and now he's moving to the younger people. And in this case, as I pointed out in years gone by, I think that younger people probably start somewhere around 20, just because of what it says in Numbers 14, that all of you who are numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and up and above. And I'm talking about how Peter would use the word, not necessarily how we would use it today, because I think we're all aware that a 13-year-old is not a man. But at the same time, if he's a member of the church, he's a brother. I'm not sure this verse would not be including him, but for the most part, God seems to give people the benefit of the doubt, and until you've reached the age of 20, there's a possibility God won't hold you responsible, won't hold you accountable, because that's what he did here. Of course, that doesn't mean that some of those people weren't sinners, even though he said they could enter the promised land. Then after the age of 20, we jump to the age of 40. If you have your notes with you this evening, you can see at the bottom of page 1 that Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king, and he rejected the advice of the elders and accepted the advice of the young man who had grown up with him. So it appears that at least until the age of 40, young man would still apply. And you know, I've searched through the scriptures for years because people like to ask sometimes, how old can an elder be to be an elder? And I've never found a super good answer, but I think this gives us some parameters that at least God still speaks of people at 40 years of age as being young men, and he also speaks of people who are ready to go out to war as the individuals who would be considered the young men. And so I think that's as far as we can go on that. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Okay, well, turning to page 2, the basic nature of the class this evening is going to center around two things. The first is submission, and the second is pride and arrogance. And actually, I guess maybe you could say three things. The submission that shows itself in humility, and then the arrogance and the pride that keep some people in a situation where God has said, I'm going to have to be in battle against you. If we choose pride, it says God resists the proud, and the term resist has the idea of going into battle. It's the term that's used for two military opposing sides going against one another. All right, so the term submission in on the top of page 2 is also a military term, and it is to rank under. And of course, in the military, everybody knows who is to be saluted or who is to be considered above. In the realm of Christianity, God has asked us to look at everyone. You remember in, what was it, Philippians 2, where God said, esteem others better than yourself, and don't look to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. So the submission here has the idea of putting ourselves under other people. Don't look upon yourself, and we'll see this more fully when we get to the word pride, which has the basic meaning of thinking that you're above everyone else. So in this case, we are below everyone else. And not speaking of ability or speaking of opportunities or things like that. Paul knew that he had done more labor. Matter of fact, he says in 1 Corinthians 15, I've labored more than all the apostles, but I'm not fit to be called an apostle. So he saw himself in a very humble light. And Jesus spent a lot of time on this. We've spent a lot of time on it the last few weeks in our sermons, so I'm not going to spend an incredible amount of time on it. But on the middle of page 2, we have those verses that the Pharisees love the uppermost rooms in the feasts and the chief seats in the synagogues. And we still see this in the denominations today. Any church that is not completely and fully influenced by Jesus' teaching often strays into this, because the church is one of those areas where no one else can get to be in a position of authority anywhere else, but he can in the church. So this is a serious problem in the church, but Jesus says, not so among you. So along with husbands and wives, parents and children, citizens and civil government, masters and slaves, the younger members of the local churches are now called upon to serve. And there's two ways that this verse has been interpreted. Because of the close context with the elders of the previous verse, many people think that this is dealing with the younger people's responsibility to the eldership. And that could very well be. In Hebrews 13:17. It says, obey those who rule over you and be submissive. So exactly the same terminology that Peter uses here. But it could also be, as Leviticus 19 says, you shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man and fear your God, I am the Lord. So it could also mean, and maybe would be better to be viewed that way, that this is talking about all old people, but especially talking about the eldership. And the last statement there on the bottom of page 2, all of you be submissive to one another. So that really moves it out of the realm of even having to make the decision. If he's talking about the elders here, then in this next clause, he's also talking about the older men, the younger men. We are all to be in submission one to another. So the idea of submission, again, means to place yourself under. So a private would clearly place himself under a sergeant, and a sergeant clearly would place himself under a lieutenant. But in this case, all Christians are placing themselves under the congregations and under, the individual Christians in a congregation. All right, so before we move to humility, anybody have any thoughts on this idea of the younger members in the congregation, the what we might call the young adults, the young married, the individuals who are relatively new to the faith and relatively new to life? Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Alan?
Yes.
This matter of submission is important within probably all realms of life, but especially within the Lord's church. There's no room in the Lord's church for individual, I don't know how to take and really identify it, but just marching to his own drummer.
My mom used to say there's too many chiefs and not enough Indians, so that might...
About the same way there. But it's difficult sometimes for people to want to and be willing to work together with other people and consider the other people whenever they're involved in something. And it can cause problems. It can cause friction within a congregation. It can stifle the congregation as far as gathering information and wisdom from the older members that have been up and down the hill a few times. But it's important things like this that we pay attention to.
Yeah. As you say, older people have been through a lot of these situations, and yet a lot of younger people tend to look at older people as having very little to say. So that's a good point. All right, let's look at this term humility on the middle of page 3. As I point out, some Greek words easily translate into English. and others like this word are very complicated terms. And so we look at this, we look at this definition, and it basically has the idea of being low, being an individual who is low to the ground, somebody who recognizes that he doesn't have a lot to offer. And as we pointed out in the sermon Sunday morning, Paul said, what do you have that you didn't receive? And the answer to that is nothing. Preachers need to understand that they are created. And French makes a couple of good points here. I wanted to read through a little bit of it. One of the points that he made is that the heathen virtue of having a great soul, the having a great power, Jesus came to remove that, and he came to raise up the idea of a term that had absolutely no worth whatsoever in the Greek culture. Matter of fact, the very term is not used. No Greek writer employed it before the Christian era, because it was a slight. It was an insult. It was something that had no real value at all. The slaves were considered to be lowly, and the freeborn were considered to have great ability, and there was nothing in between. And there was no way to move yourself from one to the other. It didn't matter what you do. If you're a noble-born person, you're going to be treated with respect and reverence, and if you're a slave, you're going to be treated with contempt. And even if the slave is 10 times more intelligent and 10 times more industrious than the noble person, it doesn't going to matter. And so when Jesus came, he came to reveal that the usefulness of the human race must be prefaced and predicated on the recognition of how lowly we are, of the fact that we are merely created beings, and not only are we created beings, but we are fallen created beings. And so, regardless of intelligence or physical prowess or wisdom or accomplishments, it's never going to allow us to see ourselves in some great light. And it's critical that as Christians we understand that we've got to clothe ourselves with humility. And so I'm going to come back to this term because Paul's going to use it about three more times in this section. So we're going to look at Thayer's definition about halfway through class because he has a few more things to add. But essentially what this term has to do with is the fact that in the Greek culture, and I think it's probably pretty close to true in the American culture as well, we look at people, meek people, people who are humble, we look at them as weak. The culture. I'm not talking about Christians, I'm talking about the culture. And as we look at that, we have to understand that God sees it as one of our greatest strengths, man sees it as one of our greatest weaknesses, and somewhere in between, all of us as Christians have taken our stand. And we either see that, and again, this was the whole function of the sermon last Sunday morning, even though I didn't even know this was coming up, but the point of it was that if we can't learn how to see ourselves as lowly and allow ourselves to turn the other cheek and treat people as being more important than we are, then our relationship to God is going to be severely impacted. And it's very difficult. This is hard to leave behind, especially if you've been raised in this environment, in this culture, and we tend to see ourselves as being way more important than we are. And so God says, I want you to clothe yourselves with humility. Now, the definition of clothe down at the bottom of page 3 is to knot or tie or fasten or gird. So on page 4, I found a couple of interesting analogies here. I'm not sure if either one of them was in Peter's mind, but before we go any further, let me just make this point. This word is never used. It wasn't used in the Greek language. You can only find one use of it. Matter of fact, Moulton and Milligan said this, we have found no instance of this rare verb. So I think that Peter may be trying to take a word and make it his own meaning. And I looked at two things today. The first one is Jesus took a towel and girded himself. He took that towel and he wrapped it around himself. And then he said at the end, I have given you an example to do as I have done. So clothing ourselves with humility could be a reference to that, or it may have the reference to putting on the new man, as Paul talked about in Ephesians chapter 4 and Colossians chapter 3, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility. So we put it on as clothing. And so the analogy here is that I'm supposed to take humility and I'm supposed to wrap myself in it. It's supposed to be something that I gird on. And again, very unusual concept, not found anywhere in the Greek language and really not found anywhere else in the scriptures. So I found it, again, intriguing, so I started thinking about, I wonder why Peter did that. And may or may not have any reference to that, but Peter had a lot to learn. He was one of those disciples arguing about who's the greatest, and he was the disciple in the garden who said, even if everybody, I won't. I'm greater than all of these. Well, he learned pretty quickly that that was not the case. And so it may be that he learned a good lesson from that, and he hasn't forgotten it. Any question or comments or thoughts on the idea of humility? Okay, starting now in the middle of page 4, he uses a Greek word for, which is the reason or cause why we need to have humility. And that is, God arranges himself in battle against the proud, but he arranges himself in gifts that we don't deserve, in gracious loving kindness and compassion to those who are humble. So clearly, I want to clothe myself with humility because I want to be on God's side. I want God to see me as on his side. I don't want to allow my false view of myself to put myself and or any of us to put ourselves into a situation where God is going to be opposed to us. Now, most of the people who read this section, they understand that Peter uses this term, and so does James. Quotes the exact same verse. It's found in one of the Proverbs, but in the Proverbs, it's worded just a little bit differently. In the proverb, it's, he scorns the scornful and gives grace to the humble. But when we look at the definitions of the Hebrew word there and the Greek word here, I think we'll see a pretty good tie together. So on the bottom of page 4, we have a definition coming from French again. I really like him. He spends a lot of time. You know, sometimes I have to read 3 or 4 pages just to pull out these definitions, but it's always worth the time. And so he basically makes this point, and I'm going to read part of the definition at the bottom of page 4. He that is sick of this sin compares himself, it may be secretly or openly, with others, and lifts himself above others in honor, preferring himself. So that's basically the idea of this sin, is someone who has viewed other people, looks down on other people with disdain, and recognizes in himself something that is better than anyone else. And he gives Haman as a good example of this, and we'll talk about him in just a few moments. Toward the middle of this quote, it has that it, his indignation, it's talking about Haman, his indignation and his cruelty and revenge were kindled because the honor and observance of greatness that Mordecai wouldn't give him caused him to feel like he needed to destroy the entire Jewish nation. Now, he says it's a perversion of a noble character, because nobler, when one falls into it, they fall more deeply and sin more fearfully. And so this is a serious problem. It is something that causes people to think that they're above the rules, that they're above any other individual or any other circumstance, and so they despise and hold others in contempt. So God resist these kind of people? Because they need help. If God doesn't resist them, which could be chastening, as the Hebrew writer talks about in Hebrews chapter 12. So the Old Testament term, God scorns the scornful, means to mock, deride, or it's just the idea of somebody who expresses utter contempt. And so what happens to Naaman? Well, he gets hung on his own gallows. And so God showed utter contempt to this man who made up his mind he was going to destroy not just Haman, but the entire Jewish nation and the God of the entire Jewish nation. So God turns it around. His contempt for the Jews and for God, the God of the Jews, was turned around, and that contempt was heaped on himself. So we have two very distinct qualities here, and as Christians, we need to learn how to recognize them. We are either humble or we are proud. Really isn't much in between. We either think too much of ourselves or we think soberly. Paul said in Romans chapter 12, I urge you not to think more highly of yourself, but to think soberly as God has given to each one of us a measure of faith. So it's God who gives us our ability to which we can measure out our faith. He gave Noah the ark to measure out his faith. He gave Abraham leaving his country and offering up his son as a measure of faith. He gave to each one of us this opportunity to show our faith by the opportunities that he gives to us. So if, like Paul or Moses, they say, well, we're a little higher than the rest of you, Paul, great apostle, Moses, the leader of the Jewish people, taking them out of Egypt. And yet, if we had been born in the days of Noah, maybe God would have picked us to take those people out. If we had been born in the days of Moses, maybe God would have picked us or Noah or any of those people. So when we feel contempt for other people, when we are scorning them, and like I said, we talked about this Sunday morning, road rage is the manifestation of utter contempt and disdain of the rights of other people. Yes, people make mistakes when they're driving, and yes, sometimes they're even rude while they're driving, but that doesn't give us the right to respond in kind. A humble person is going to turn the other cheek. A proud, arrogant, contemptuous person is going to look down upon them. Because that's really the basic meaning of this term, is that when somebody gets in my way, I'm going to crush them like a bug. They have no rights. They have no reason to treat me like this. I'm number one. They're number two. And this is what this pride is. And God says, if you have it, I'm going to help you get rid of it. And I'm not going to be gentle. I'm going to treat you with powerful, even the military concept. This has got to be beaten out of us. It's got to be removed, because we'll never get to heaven as long as we have it. Bottom of page 5, of course, we have these verses in the Psalms. Sixth thing the Lord hates, 7, an abomination. And the first one is a proud look. Then we turn to page 6. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride, and arrogance. Then verse chapter 16, 5, the proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. It's disgusting to the Lord. Because, as I said, we're creatures. God is the creator, and we are the created. There's no room for pride in the heart of a person who believes in God and trusts God. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. And then the one that I think is very apropos to today, there is a generation that is pure in its own eyes, yet is not washed from its filthiness. There is a generation, oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. And so we have this situation in our nation today, and I'm fearful that a lot of people have become much more arrogant and much more proud and much less likely to look upon others with favor and with a desire to serve, simply because of the culture, simply because of the attitudes in the culture. And we got to conquer this. So we've got to know the difference between humility that will cause us to serve and be kind and gentle, and the arrogance and pride that'll cause us to despise and look down on people. I mean, kind of gone a little bit long here. Does anybody have any thoughts on this pride and humility and the distinctions and how God treats people differently if they have the one over the other? Okay, well, toward the top of page 6, we have the Greek word for resists. And it's interesting, it's got the same meaning. Remember, hupotasso meant to arrange under. And now we have antitasso, which means to arrange against. And once again, this is a military term, and it means to prepare for battle, to arrange in battle order, to set an army in array against someone. So if you want God setting himself against you, then just allow that pride to stay. Just allow yourself to look down on others with contempt and just to look upon people as existing for our service. And if they're not serving us, then like Haman, they need to be destroyed or they need to be damaged. And this, of course, I think is emphasized in Luke 18 when Jesus says that parable. This is in the middle of page 6. He spoke a parable to those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. And I'd never really picked up on that despised others before, but this time I really did, because that's basically the definition of pride. So these people not only trusted in themselves, but they looked down upon and despised other people. And then he starts his prayer, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, especially like this tax collector over here. And the other man is saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus is saying that the publican went home with God, hearing his prayer and forgiving him, but the wicked man, the Pharisee, who thought he was better, turns out that he wasn't better at all. So if we have this emotion, you know, and like I said earlier, you know, you'll see it in the home, you'll see it among husbands and wives, parents and children, you'll see it on the workplace, and you'll see it on the roads. And sadly, sometimes you see it in the church. Somebody comes in, you remember that congregation James talked about, the wealthy man comes in and the poor man comes in, and you despise the poor man because you see him as beneath you, when the reality is he's a brother. And if we want God to look upon us as enemies, if we want God to see us as someone who is opposed to everything that he stands for, then we can allow this pride to just keep right on going. But if we want God to show us grace, then in the middle of page 6, it says, he gives grace to the humble. So to the pride, he draws himself up in battle array. And this is what happened to Balaam. You remember when Balaam left home and the angel of the Lord was in battle array. He was standing there with his sword drawn, and the donkey saw it. And finally, the angel of the Lord said, your way is perverse before me, and I was ready to put you to death because of his covetousness and his lack of care and concern for the Jewish people, which ultimately ended up with him teaching Balak how to get his beautiful young women to go try to tempt the Israelites into committing adultery and spiritual adultery with idolatry. And so, same concept, God will arrange himself against anyone who is manifesting this pride, because pride goes before destruction. So I need to purge it. I need to look for it. I need to purge it. I need to be sure that humility is growing, pride is lessening, pride is being destroyed and removed, and humility is being placed instead. So all of us need to look for that. You know, like I told you on Sunday morning, go home, ask your spouse, do I manifest any of these characteristics? Because we need to get rid of them. If we are treating others with contempt, if we are not manifesting this humility in which we're trying to serve other people and be a blessing to other people, then that's what we can expect from God. But if we are humble, then we can expect grace. So grace is the favor, the loving kindness, the desire to be a blessing. So what do we want? Do we want battle with God, or do we want grace from God? And that's the choice that Peter's giving here, is that we can have grace or we can have this battle array. Now, the word humble here is a little bit different than the one above. The one above was a noun, and this one, I believe, is a verb. And so he is giving grace to those people who show and manifest humility. And so we look at this definition. This time I picked Kittle's definition because I think it also really helps us understand. Basically, the basic meaning of this word in the Greek culture is that someone is small and insignificant. And so, and then he makes this point at the very bottom of page 6. The aristocratic culture of ancient Greek, the worth of a man was determined by his parentage. A noble mind and virtue were inherited. Okay? They were inherited and could not be acquired. So if you were born to the wrong parents, then you were this word. You were someone who has a low estate. And you've got poor and petty relations, especially a slave, then you're considered to be base and low, and the only thing you can do as a slave is serve, and the only way you can be great is if you were born in the right family. And that's a terrible situation. I think we see something similar to that in England in the, the 16th, 15th century, where if you were born to a lord, you were a lord. If you were born to a slave, you were a slave, and never the two could meet. And so this was something that Jesus had to combat. When he used the word, that's what they heard. When he used the word humble, they heard someone who was born to the wrong parents and who has a lowly, worthless situation. And so we have to break through that, because that, again, that is how many perceive it in this culture. If you act low, it's because you don't have anything. The only reason someone would act as a servant is because they don't have any of the things that we have that would make them act like we act, and therefore, those people are lowly. And it's a real temptation. Now, God says, I'm going to give grace to people like that, but the world looks down upon that with contempt. And so, as I said earlier, we have to make some important decisions here. Are we going to allow our life to be directed by the world and be influenced by worldly thinking? Or are we going to look at the scriptures and say to ourselves, God has placed this greatness into humility, into people who see themselves low from the ground? And if that's not how we see ourselves, we need to try to figure out why. Why would I see myself as more highly than I should? What's going on here? Where did I pick this up? Because I didn't get it in the scriptures. This is a misapplication. Again, what do we have that we didn't receive? Nothing. We are all creatures created by God, given our abilities by God, our lives by God, our bodies by God, whatever strengths and weaknesses we have by God, and therefore, we need to recognize that just because I can do something that you can't do doesn't make me better. It just makes me different. Just like the eye can see and the hand can pick something up or touch and the ear can hear. But that doesn't make any of them greater than anything else. All right, before we start into the final conclusion, does anyone want to weigh in on this or talk about this a little bit? I think it's a very important concept, and I would appreciate anybody else's insight or observations regarding it.
Alan, I was, I personally like examples. And of course, we've got Hebrews 11, but we got the entire scriptures. But look just at even Hebrews 11 and each one of those stories and how humility played into their being pleasing to God. Of course, Jesus is the ultimate example of humility, but he expects his servants, the ones that we have recorded as being pleasing to him, just look at the situations that they were in, how they had to be humble, how they had to lower themselves, they had to think of others. I mean, you mentioned Noah and Abraham. I mean, just look at all the examples we have. And, you know, it's definitely a much-needed subject today. And can we look back on our own life and, like you're saying, even ask other people how they view us? You know, do I come across as humble servant, or am I arrogant, and is it all about me and my experiences in life and what I've done, and you know, forget about what other people, what their situation is. So it's definitely, a lesson that is well needed today for all of us.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right. And you're right. Examples are a tremendous advantage to us. That's why the scriptures have so many of them in there. Anybody else have a thought?
No, I was just, this is Ken. I was just comparing what you were saying with where I've been in my career. Most of my career was a meritocracy, and it was like, you know, if you could do it, you were, people looked up to you, you know, and it's so different from what I read about Joseph, who was, I don't see anything bad in the scriptures about what Joseph.
Yeah, no, Joseph is a great example of humility and submission to God. Jesus is perhaps the greatest example of that.
Oh, absolutely. And
so we have the ability. We can see it in Paul. We can see it in Peter. We can see it in Jesus. We can see the negative side of this when they were first converted, those apostles constantly, I'm better than you, I'm better than you, I'm greater. And we need to understand that that's something we don't need to have. Virgil, I noticed it went back on. I was going to say your mic went off, so I thought maybe you wanted to say something.
No.
Okay.
I didn't realize it was still on, Hal.
oh, no, it wasn't, but you just turned it off, and I thought, well, maybe he's getting ready to comment, because I know sometimes you can't get it on fast enough, so. Did you say no, you have no comments?
Well.
Of course not. Go ahead.
But I think that the comments that we've already heard, Robert's comment, Ken's, and what you had to say about it is right on. You know, it's, humility is a difficult thing to deal with, and it's probably harder, like for a person that is a military man, a commanding officer, to display the art of being full of humility, but still commanding hundreds or thousands of troops in the battle. Somebody has to be the stand-up, go-forward guy. And it's difficult sometimes.
Right. Well, but if a man like that will just, in his own mind, think, I'm in this position to make these decisions, and I'm going to do the very best I can to serve the people who are under me by making the best possible decisions so that they can come back alive and so that we can win this battle. And I think leadership, as you say, if you're a husband, if you're a parent, if you're an employer, if you're in the government, then your concept of service needs to bend to the fact that whatever rules and circumstances or whatever discipline you choose to put forth, it's in the best interest of that person, not simply because you're frustrated or angry. No. I always told parents, don't spank your kids just because you're angry. That's not why we do it.
Most of the military commanders in, I guess, in my time, my day that I know of, that have risen above and become very well known and regarded, are also, they have this humble trait in them. And they're not like Attila the Hun. They did what they needed to do, but then they stopped many times where they could have continued on. And these things are traits of humbleness. And the same way within our society. It's a good trait when we take and see people that are willing to put themselves out and move something in the direction that should. But if it goes too far, then it's not good, and to stop before it gets there.
Right.
Anyway, that would be all that I had. So your comments and Robert's and Ken's are very good, too.
Well, I appreciate that, Virgil. Anybody else have any thoughts on this before we move on?
Hey, Alan?
Yes.
My thought would be, I know most of us in this class are past this part in our lives with teaching our own children, but this is a trait that needs to be taught in children from a very young age. And us as grandparents and even great-grandparents, we can help our grandkids, our great-grandkids, and those that might be coming up having kids to start teaching this when they're very young. Because if you don't start it when they're young, you can't expect them to know what to do when they get older.
Well, and that's a good point. We've got to move them in the right direction while we can, because the days will come when they're not going to move anymore. Okay. Anybody else? All right. Well, in the middle of page 7, we have the final therefore. This is the final conclusion of the book. Now, it goes on for a while. That's why I went ahead and put that verse on the bottom of page 7. This is the final section of Peter. And he gives us basically 5 points. The first one is, well, actually 6 points, because the first one is humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. But then cast your anxiety on him. Be sober and diligent. Vigilant, because your adversary, the devil. The third point, resist him steadfast in your faith. The fourth point, you know that the same sufferings are being experienced by your brotherhood in the world. And then the fifth point is a prayer. May the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory, perfect, establish, and strengthen and settle you. So this is it. And then his final exhortation. So this is his final therefore, and he prefaces it one final time with humility, and then he moves to the great responsibilities that we need to shoulder if we're going to get to heaven. And so the first point that he makes is, once again, and we have another word here, this is another verb, and this time it's in the command mode. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. That's a command. And if we can't see God as greater than we are, we can't see God like Jesus did in the Garden of Gethsemane, saying, nonetheless, not my will, but your will be done, then we need to. We need to learn how to do this. And it's a difficult thing to learn. As I said, we're used to, especially if we didn't have parents that taught us otherwise, we're used to pretty much doing things our way. And when somebody tells us to do something, we kind of say to them, well, who are you? What right do you have to tell me what to do? Well, we have that attitude toward God, then we're in serious trouble. So, as I said, I don't want God as my enemy. I don't want God to see me as someone he needs to break down. And so if we can do it ourselves, then we don't have to deal with this. So humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. We turn now to page 8. And this is a term that we all need to recognize. I've got two sets of verses here. The first one has to do with God being the potter, us being the clay, and who are we to speak back to God? And so we need to humble ourselves under his hand. And whatever life brings, we're going to handle it the way God wants it to be handled. And these people were getting ready to suffer extreme persecution. Many of them would die. Many of them would lose their liberty. Many of them would watch their family members die. And so they needed to have a humble attitude like Jesus did. Sometimes life turns in a different direction, but we never would have thought it would have. And when that day comes, doubting God is not an option. We have to carry it through to the end, even if it means death or imprisonment or any other thing. And the other section that I think is wise is the section on the middle of page 8, which is, first of all, Isaiah 64. We are all like an unclean thing, and all our righteousness is like filthy rags. We all fade as a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, have taken us away. And no matter how long we've been a Christian, and no matter how many things we've conquered, we can't do away with that truth. Because whatever sins we committed before we became a Christian, they're only forgiven by God's mercy. They are not. We are not righteous by right. We squandered that long ago. And no matter what we do after, our righteousness is still like filthy rags. And so God has four verses here that he wants us to give careful consideration to. The first one in Psalm 34, the Lord is near to those who have a broken heart and who tremble at my word. Well, actually, that's not that verse. I'm sorry. I'm Billy At just wrote and said he's struggling to get on tonight. I just don't think there's much I can do to help him. So I'm just going to answer him real quick. Oh, never mind. I'll get to him in a minute. We're just about done. So the Lord is near to those who have a broken heart and saves those who have a contrite spirit. Same thing in Psalm 51. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. Isaiah 57. Thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity. I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the spirit of the contrite ones. And then he says the same thing in 66. On this one I will look, he who has a poor and contrite spirit, who trembles at my word. And I didn't put it in there, but we could also put Matthew 5. Blessed are the poor in spirit. So humility has to do with the recognition that regardless of how much scripture I know, regardless of how many people I've converted, regardless of how much wisdom I have, or whatever it might be, I need to have a broken and a contrite heart. Remember that parable. This man comes before God, and he sets all others at naught, and he despises them because he thinks he's better. Well, no one is better. There's no one in the church better, no one in the church more intelligent or less sinful. We're all there by grace. We need to have this broken heart and contrite spirit. Paul never lost it. You're still seeing it in 2 Timothy and 1 Timothy, where he talks about being less than the least of all the saints. He never forgot. Yeah, he was forgiven, but he never forgot where he'd come from. And we can't either. Remember, Peter's going to tell us in 2 Peter, don't forget the cleansing of your sins. Don't forget the day that you became a Christian, because that's the day that separates us. But why? Because of the grace and the mercy of God. So we need to have this sense of humility as Jesus did in the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, on the bottom of page 8, this is so that he can exalt us in due time. We've got to see ourselves as we are. God sees us this way, and on the judgment day, he's going to make it very clear to us. This is how you were. But because you recognized it and you worked within the confines of what I told you, then you can be saved. There's two passages that really emphasize this. First one is in Hebrews 11. Rob brought up Hebrews 11 earlier. In Hebrews 11, 1, it says that the elders obtained a good testimony because they humbly submitted by faith to whatever God asked them to do. Then at the very end, it says the same thing. All these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promises. So if we want God to lift us up like he did those people in Hebrews 11, then we have to humble ourselves now. We've got to do what's necessary for God to be able to give us the grace, the mercy, the love, the devotion, the salvation that he longs to give us. And so verse 7 is our last point that we want to cover this evening, and that is casting your care upon him. Now, that's what the Lord did in the Garden of Gethsemane. And I think that's Peter's point here. Peter knows what's coming. He knows that the fiery trial is just about upon them. And when those cares and concerns are going to come, because whenever we lose control, whenever the life we thought was stable and the life we thought was going to continue on, and then suddenly we get hit with something where we don't have any control and life's not going to continue on the way we thought it was, then those cares and concerns are going to come. And God says, just give them to me. And verse 9, at the bottom of page 9, you will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on you, because he trusts in you. So if we trust in the Lord with all our heart and we don't lean on our own understanding, then we're going to be in a position where we know. We know that God is going to care for us. We know that God is going to take care of us. That was Paul's point, the next verse on the top of page 10, be anxious for nothing, or do not be continually anxious for anything, but in everything by prayer, supplication, and thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. So these people were going to be going under persecution. What was their request to God? Well, it might have been for escape, but when escape was no longer possible, then it would be for the faith and the commitment and the conviction to carry it through to the end. So the Lord has given us this opportunity to declare ourselves. We can be humble, we can be submissive, we can have a meek and quiet spirit, or we can be proud and arrogant and look upon ourselves more highly than we ought to think. When God sees a creature that he created looking too highly, then he gets out the battle array. And so we have to recognize that God cares about us, that he loves us, and he trusts us. We're never going to be tempted above what we're able to bear. And so when a situation comes up, we say, wow, I don't know if I can handle this. Yes, you can. And we simply have to trust in the Lord. He cares for us. He's never going to allow us to be put in a situation that's not going to be in our best interests. Anybody have any thoughts on this as we wind the class down?
Alan, this ideal of prayer, or the what's taught about prayer, I say to myself, I could pray 20 times a day, and I still don't think I'm praying enough. And it's such a blessing that I really think, I know personally, I don't know about anybody else, that I just don't access as much as I think I should. And especially, like you're talking about, during the day, I mean, if you're having difficulties and you stop and pray, what a blessing we have, because it refocuses our minds and thoughts upon that which is spiritual. How can you be praying and not have God's word focused in your mind? You know, so there's so much taught on it, and me personally, I just need to do a whole lot more of it.
Well, I would say a good hearty amen to that, because I feel the same way. I can never, no matter how much I pray, I know it's not enough. Sometimes I know I'm not praying enough. And, well, you know, Jesus talked about this in the sermon up on the mount when he said that we should pray, lead us not into temptation. And I've often looked at that verse and thought, why would you pray that? We know God can't be tempted with evil, and yet that's how the Lord worded it. And I think it was a stark reminder that God has the ability to lead us away from temptation and never lead us into temptation, which means anytime I'm tempted, that's my first order. My first response when I'm being tempted is to pray. Quote scripture and pray. Jesus quoted scripture, and he told us to pray. Anybody else? Or Rob, were you done?
Yeah, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. And the very last few verses on the bottom of page 10, I'm not going to spend any time on it because we're out of time, but as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his mercy. He cares about us. He loved us and sent his son to die for us while we were sinners and enemies. So we don't need to ever misconstrue what's going on. God loves us. He cares for us. He's always acting in our best interests. He is a God of love. And we need to trust him. And when things don't go our way, instead of getting angry, instead of thinking about, well, I'm not going to serve you anymore, or worse, to blaspheme God, as so many have, that shouldn't even be in our minds. It shouldn't even be something we think about. All right, that's all I wanted to cover today. I think we'll probably finish the book next week, and then we'll move into 2 Peter. So let's kind of plan on that. Of course, you know me. We may not make it, but I think we will. We don't have a lot to cover. Anybody have any other comments before Brian leads us in prayer?
What's the rush?
Well, no rush. No rush at all. Except we've got 66 more books to cover before we die, Ken.
Well, okay.
So that might be a rush. All right, Brian, you want to lead us in prayer, please?